going to talk about sabbaticals. Some of you have heard us present on this before. I present on behalf of the pastoral staff, and so we are the ones that get to benefit from the church offering sabbaticals to us. And so I'm going to speak about on behalf of all of us, so you kind of understand the idea of what the sabbatical is and why we do it. And then I will deal with mine, particularly what's going to go on mine this coming summer. And when a staff person is gone, their responsibilities are taken up by other staff persons. So everything keeps running and being taken care of. A sabbatical is a pretty unusual thing in Baptist life. It is somewhat common in other denominations and church organizations. They've been doing it for years. I've met a number of them when they were actually on sabbatical. And historically, in the universities which were Christian, there were sabbaticals and so forth. And the sabbaticals have continued in the universities, but they have fallen by the wayside in the churches. And I think that's sad, and particularly in Baptist churches, just the way we're designed. But let me give you a definition so you kind of understand. After you come to Trinity, after 10 years, you are eligible to take a sabbatical. It doesn't work like a vacation. So if you come in and you've been in ministry 10 years, then you would get the full vacation just like you had been here 10 years. But the sabbatical is different. It's not a part of a vacation or anything like that. It's just the grace of Trinity Baptist Church. So you have to actually have served this church for 10 years. And then every 7 years thereafter, you are eligible. So I would say that this is what we say about it in the definition. You should have PowerPoints. Do you have that? Huh? That's two out of two. Not my fault. I'm not keeping account of wrongs done, but shortly. It's tough, I'll tell you. There'll be. That's exactly right. Yeah. Sound, they're vying for it. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and speak here. So I'll give you these and they'll get caught up with me in a moment. But the sabbatical is a specific period of time off granted to the minister for in-depth focus on professional and spiritual renewal and calling. So it has a specific design. It's not just something that you just decide to do. And actually, when you go on sabbatical, if you're a staff, one of the staff pastors, then they have to present a plan to me, and then I approve it, and then it goes to the elders for final approval. And like mine, it goes directly to the elders, and then they approve it. And then when I come back, or the others, when we come back, we have to report on our progress on the plan that we turned in. Did we get it accomplished, and so forth and so on. So it's a structured thing. The need of it, let me tell you what it is not, what a sabbatical is not. It is not deserved. None of us assume that at all. It's just an act of grace by the church. So I think as a church, we owe staff a vacation. We owe them a salary, but we don't owe them a sabbatical. We do this to enhance their ministry and life in our church and thereby our church. It is not because we work hard, because all of you work hard. So it's not related to us working hard. Everybody works hard. It is not an extended vacation. So thus the plan. There's time off, there's things about the family and so forth, which I'll mention, but it has a specific purpose. So it's not a vacation, it's not deserved, and it's not because we work hard. So what is it? And this is a quote. We use this from John Piper's church, and it just summarizes when they were talking about their sabbaticals, and we read a lot of policies on this and different ways that they do it, and so we liked this and we took it, and so we adapted it to us. So Trinity Baptist Church wants its pastors to be spiritually and mentally healthy, growing in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ, and on the cutting edge of the best biblical and strategic thinking in their particular ministry areas. We desire for our staff to thrive in ministry, find periodic refreshment, and avoid burnout. And so the average Southern Baptist or Baptist pastor stays in a church, and you can find different numbers on this, but it's somewhere between 2 and 4 years. And yet the most effective years of a pastor being a shepherd are 5 years and beyond. So they never get to that most effective place. And the church just is continually in turmoil, because when you have a pastor 2 to 4 years, and then you spend another year, year and a half getting a pastor, and then you go through that cycle, it stops you from developing as the body of Christ, as a church family, as a spiritual unit. So many, many, unfortunately, end up staying in the job, the pastorate, long after the passion has waned. And they've lost it because of, we use the term burnout, but it's just everything they gave themselves to ended up draining them of everything they have, and there's no moment for refreshment. And I this is a digression from what I have here, but I remember, and I've told you this before, but it never has changed. I spoke in an ethics class at Midwestern Seminary back in the early 90s, and there was about 7 pastors. And so we were talking to students, and they asked, so what is the greatest threat to you as a pastor? And so some said, you know, women being involved with another woman, which is true. Some said money. Those are the two big things that are mentioned. And then there were other things listed, and I happened to be last. And when they got to me, I said, the biggest threat is losing your time with God every day. That's the biggest threat, because all of these other things flow from that. And so we have to maintain that on a daily basis, but there needs to be time that's not under any pressure at all of the pastors just being with God, so that they can be what they need to be when they're with you. Because if they're not, you're the one that gets hurt by that. So the purpose, it's a threefold purpose. And the first one is spiritual. And this portion of time is for the concentration on one's own personal spiritual growth, refreshment, renewal, and examination for relational benefit between God and the individual. It's very focused on that person being under no obligations except to enhance their relationship with God in this time that's unencumbered. And that's what you need. I mean, you don't just need somebody that functions well. You need somebody that knows and walks with God in a deep way. And so the sabbatical has that as its first function. The second is our purpose. Ministerial. This time is for concentration on enhancing and improving one's ministerial ability in order to benefit the work of God in and through the church. And so this relates to whatever that pastor's responsibilities are. If it's college, if it's associate pastor like Ryan, if it's music like Randy, then they are to enhance their abilities in that area. And mine would be studying and learning more of the scripture and about God, and my whole desire is to know God and his person, his ways, his works, and his will, and that has been since the day I was saved. So that's very specific. What I'll be doing, they will not be doing with the level that I'm doing it, and I won't be doing what they're doing with the level that they're doing it. And then it's personal, and that is marital and familial enhancement and enrichment. And this focuses upon the relationship of the pastor with their family and with their wives. And so we specifically wrote in that we want the wives going with the pastors, and we want them to be there with them, because it's an unusual thing that when you're pastoring, your wife is involved in it in every sense of the word. Every person they know, every family they know, every problem they know. It's unlike anything else. In other words, if you're an attorney or you work here or you're a plumber, I mean, your wife doesn't know every customer and talk to every customer. So they're intricately involved and they need refreshment, and your marriages need refreshed, and your families. And one of the great cautions of young pastors is they don't realize how consuming being a pastor is. And I lay this out to every one of them that's going into it, and I explain it. But and I just talked to one in the last week or week and a half and said, yeah, you really don't get it till you're in it. And then it starts consuming you because there's no end. There's no end when you walk off at the end of the day or at the end of the week. It didn't end. Everything's still going and there are great needs. And so this is why many times children of preachers' kids end up hating the church. Because it took, in their view, their dad away from them. So we didn't do that. And our children love the church and are involved in the church and so forth. So, but this is a part of that, of enhancing the family and the relationship with a husband and wife out from under a pressured environment where, I mean, my schedule it just goes on and on. And so, and hers is very busy. And I mean, things we do together in Oxford, which maybe I'll mention in a moment, we never do here because there is no time. We can dream about it. We can say, we need to do this when we get home. Yeah, and we don't because there's no time. You know, life just gets really busy. So that's kind of generally speaking. My sabbatical this year will start on May 3rd. And I come back on August 22nd. And for me personally, so now this is about how it comes about in my life. It's the burden of being a pastor and the shepherd. And the burden of the pastor or the heart of a pastor is one of those indefinable things. I mean, we can define it, but to make it understandable, you just don't get it unless you're in it. I mean, it's just really, really hard. I try and I do different things, but it's kind of, you've heard of people saying, well, it's the X factor. So that person has it. They have that X factor. Well, what is it? Well, and they're trying to define it, but you know when someone has it, but it's hard to really lay out. And you know when someone doesn't have it. Well, it's the same thing with a pastor and the shepherd's heart. And it's a love that's very deep, and it grows deeper the longer you're there. So when you're there 2 or 3 years, it's there, but it's nothing like when you've been there 24 years like I have. I've worked on construction, building houses, digging ditches. I was a brakeman and a conductor on the Rock Island Railroad for 8 years. I was in management in a grocery chain, and I owned my own business, small business, for 5 years, and nothing has ever drained me spiritually, period. But pastoring does. Because there are a lot of reasons, but on a familial level, so, you know, the Bible holds us up as the family, as a family. Well, there's so many wonderful things about that. But in a family, if you take your individual family, when one of your family members is sick or hurting or they've been in a tragedy or whatever it is, you feel that acutely. And no matter what you do, you can't get away from it. So you heard about someone else having that same trouble, and you may have hurt and been sad, but it's not like when it's your family. It takes it out of you. Well, that's the way I view the church. And so that's the pastor's heart that has that kind of love for the church body. And so, you know, maybe when I grow up, I'll get where I can handle it better. But I don't do well. I never get out from under that burden. And I think about it all the time. And when I hear it, so I can hear that someone else is suffering in another church or love that Christian church, but it's just not the same. It's the burden of the shepherd with the flock that God has given him the ministry with and over. And so you feel everything. And to get out from under that for a little bit really lets you know how much you're under 24/7, and it never really leaves. Again, just like if it was your family going through something. So your spiritual well-being and your troubles and your hurts, and, you know, I know so many of you, we've walked together through so many phases of your life and so forth. But, I take all of that really serious in prayer and life and being concerned about you. And I feel it acutely and I can't shake it. So whether I'm supposed to be able to or not, I don't know. Some say you are, but I'm not able to. I am absolutely incapable of doing what is necessary as your pastor. So I sense that greatly. For example, when I was a brakeman, I was a pretty good brakeman. I could switch cars pretty fast. I could read a list and do these things. And when I was a conductor, I could figure, when I owned a business. But that don't feel that way in the pastorate. You feel woefully inadequate, because who can affect the spiritual lives of others if you're not walking intensely with God and God working through you in their lives? So there's no one in the world on planet Earth that wants the spiritual development of you and your family more than I do. We may have elders who want it as much as I do, but not more. And I think about it all the time. And I mean all the time. I give out spiritually all that I have. I try not to reserve it. I just give whatever God's given to me, and I give that to you. And the most important thing is that I have to keep walking with God. And so the sabbatical is, for me, is a part, that is a huge part of it, of this refreshing time and so forth. For example, I've been on past sabbaticals, and not counting the ones that I've had at Trinity, for 15 months. So in my ministry, I've been on sabbatical 15 months. None of them were planned. None of them were paid. And none of them I had a place to go to when it ended. It's just God took me and set me aside. And so I still got up every morning just like I do now and met with him and tried to figure out what he was teaching me and what he wanted me to do. And so that's about 15 months. The longest was 7 months. Others were 2 months to 3 months. And just before I came here, God put me on a sabbatical, unpaid, not knowing where I was going. I didn't know there was a Trinity Baptist Church. And that lasted for 3 months. And I went up into the Ozark Mountains alone, isolated, just me and the animals and my Bible and books, and spent time up there just trying to nail some things down about God and me and what I needed to do and so forth. And that was really revolutionary in my life coming here, although I didn't know I was coming here, you see. So it's not that I'm doing it because it's paid for. I did it for months through the years with no pay, nowhere to go. But it is essential to staying close to God as I desire to. But you have made it much easier by helping financially and knowing that I have a place to come to after it's over. I just want to tell you that's really a big difference. I'm just telling you. It's nice. Because the other times I didn't know when the sabbatical was going to end and I didn't know what I would be doing afterwards. And so that's really a blessing and I thank you for that. There are different seasons in a pastor's life, in my life specifically. And so my heart has been, since God called me to pastor, I just was going to study and pray and counsel people and preach and visit. And just that was my heart. And the first church I went to was a very small church in South Arkansas. But my mind was I was going there for life. I never dreamed I would leave that church. Never dreamed it. And a lot of guys talk to me and they'll say, yeah, I'm here, but I know I won't be here long. See, I never had that sense. I thought that was it. And I pastored like that, but I left there. I was only there a year. And then the last church I was in, where I was 13 years, again, never dawned on me that I would leave. Never had a thought to leave. Never, nothing. I was there because that was the flock God had given me. And then one day, I've shared the story, but in prayer, he made it known to me that I was going to leave. And I didn't know where I was going, but I ended up coming here. So I've come here with the same heart that I didn't come here to go somewhere else. There's been nothing else in my vision, on my horizon. If it wasn't going to happen here, it wasn't going to happen. That's the way I look at it. And so my heart has always been the longevity and ministering to one family and one church family and one flock. And in all of that, it's meeting with people, it's counseling people, it's walking through the trials of life with them, it's preaching the Word of God, it's seeing what God does in people's lives, watching them change over a year, over the years, and watching families come through trials, and some don't make it, and that's always very, very sad. But in the pastorate, God has brought other things into my life with this, though I never wanted it. And I can actually take you back to the time of fasting and prayer, and I can take you to the book, because I actually looked it up again the other day. It's in Spiritual Leadership, and I was fasting and praying during a week one time, and God, right at the end of the fast, I mean, I didn't have but a few minutes left. God hadn't really given me any significant thing and direction, and right at the end, I just felt impressed to go read this page in this book. Now, you got to understand, I'd read the book twice. So I'm sitting over on a couch in my study, and I'm just kind of fighting the idea because it's really close to the time of the end. And I've read the book twice, Lord. But anyway, I ended up going over, and what I turned to was something that I had not highlighted, and I highlight about everything. I underline a lot, and it wasn't underlined, nothing. And it was about an old preacher, and he just wanted to pastor the flock and study in his library and be among the people. But God had other things for him, and he finally accepted that. And the Lord used that to speak to me about I had to be open to being a part of the influence of the church I pastor in other areas. Like we have mission trips, what we're saying is we want Trinity Baptist Church to have an influence in this country, in this area. If we're involved in pro-life, we want to have Trinity having an influence. So I saw that in my life. But I didn't know what that meant. I have learned some now. So specifically, there have been four moves in the SBC that I've been a part of, a small part, but been a part. And one of them was what's known as the Conservative Resurgence or the Renaissance. And that's where the convention had gone liberal, and for the first time in history, others split and did different things, but nothing like what happened in our convention, that it actually turned back conservative, placed inerrantists in all of our seminaries and all of our institutions, all of our professors, on and on and on. And it was truly a move of God, and some historians have said it was the greatest move of God in the 20th century. So I was involved, very, very small part, but I was involved and very supportive, and that went on for over a quarter of a century. And the Lord, you know, gave us a great victory. Another thing is the issue of Calvinism. And you know, I've written three books. The third one's coming out that touches on that, on Calvinism. And I have spoken on it in different places, and I write on it a lot. And I'm involved with people who are coming out of Calvinism. You may not know about it, but you hear about the people going in, but there are many people coming out, and I deal with a number of them. And again, dealing with a guy this week that we've just got to know each other, who came out of it and did an interview the other day with a guy who had come out of it. And so I'm just saying, that I've been involved in that. So the two biggest things in the convention, if you want to know what are the biggest things in the convention, those have been the two biggest, and God has had me involved in it, though I did not seek it nor desire it. You have to understand that. I don't have any aspirations except to know God and pass as far as vocationally Trinity Baptist Church. That's it. Another thing that happened was this critical race theory and cultural Marxism. So I was studying this back in 2016-17, but I was just doing that because I've tried to read broadly and study things and try to see how the Word of God applies to that, but never knew that we would be engrossed in this battle for the life of the convention and the gospel and the truth. Never dawned on me. And a lot of time when I'm studying, I have no idea where it's going or how God's going to use it. Have none. I just sense He wants me studying in an area, and I do that on top of the other things I'm preaching about and the normal things that you would know. But there's always these other areas that He brings. And so now I'm enthralled in that. But I didn't desire it or seek it, but I am in it. And so I want to be faithful to God, because like the resurgence, you have to realize, and this was said, and so Dr. Land, I heard him say it about the resurgence, but it's true now too. We have millions and millions of people. We have $2 billion in assets. We have missionaries all over the world. And we have 50,000 churches. And there's maybe 20 to 100,000 people who understand what's going on to destroy the convention. And if we all leave, what you'll leave is a shell, and people will be in it not knowing what took it down. And they will have their kids coming to Southern Baptist Church, and they'll be being taught that anti-truth theory. And so it's worth fighting for. We're fighting for other people. That's an influence. So it's not going to hurt us because we know about it. So we can take care of ourselves and go on, but we have to care about others, and we have to care about what people have given and supported and now exist. And then the Conservative Baptist Network, I've shared with you, but I'm a part of that. I was at the founding meeting. About 20 people from across the nation got together, had a meeting in Dallas. And out of that, we saw the same concerns and were troubled by the direction of the convention. And out of that, we decided that God wanted us to be a part of trying to reverse that. But I never dreamed I would ever be doing something like that. I thought that was over in my life. So I not only didn't aspire to it, I loathed the idea of having to do it again. And I think the elders would confirm, but I wept when I sensed that God wanted me to do that, because I did not want to do it. I wanted to do His will, but I didn't want to do that, because I've been through that and I know what's involved. But I think it's important. And we've seen many things happen because of the Conservative Baptist Network. And if it wasn't alive, along with a couple other things, the convention would go the way of other denominations over a period of years. There is no doubt. It was heading very fast. And there's even things in our state convention that the CBN has reversed. And if the CBN wasn't there, it would still be going on. And we have a conservative state convention, by the way. I'm just telling you, this stuff gets in, and once it does, if the people don't know what's going on and have the courage to fight it, it won't stop. So these are things outside of pastoring, but they do influence out. They take the influence of Trinity outside. Another thing was, you know, and some of you weren't here, but I was invited in 2004 to go and participate in what's called the Oxford Roundtable. It's basically a forum of about 40 people, and you present papers and do things. Well, I didn't seek that. I had a roundtable here, and I had no model for that. I just developed it out of what I thought, what I believed, and what I thought God might want. But anyway, when that happened, and I got the letter, the invitation. I'm just trying to show you, I don't aspire, I don't look for these things. I mean, I have enough to do. And so I showed it to Gina, and Gina said, well, you're going. And I said, no, I'm not going. She said, no, you're going. And I said, hun, I think they made a mistake. I don't think I'm the right Ronnie Rogers. And she said, yeah, you are. And I said, no, I'm not. So I actually called the Oxford Roundtable and told them that I thought they had sent it to the wrong person. And they said, no, we didn't. So I'm just telling you, I don't go looking for these things. But interestingly, for about 3 years, I had been studying in history, the history of education in America, going back to Rousseau, Herbert Spencer, coming up to Thorndike and ultimately Dewey and others, and had no idea what I'd ever do with that knowledge. Well, the first three times that I presented over there, that's what the papers were on. There's no way I could have studied and prepared in the time that I got the letter to the time that you meet and present. So again, I see the hand of God in that, but I didn't seek them. But I do see them as extending the influence of Trinity Baptist Church to other areas, just like we do when we go on a mission trip. Just like we do when there's a ministry that goes outside the walls of this church to other people, it's an extension of the church. So to talk about my schedule a little bit, it starts on May 3rd, and I am in the United States till May 30. And during that time, I do research and writing on this critical race theory. I've done an enormous amount of research, but I haven't written any of it other than having one document that's just quotes. And these quotes total about 60,000 words. So just quotes. This isn't my comments on them or anything like that. So a lot of books are 60,000 words. So I have enough quotes that I could just fill in the spaces and have a book, but I have a lot more quotes that probably will go into it. And as I said, I've been studying the subject since about 2016, but since about 2018 or 19 and more intensely, and then after I preached here and wrote the book, I was done. So I was ready to move on. But God has never released me from studying it. So it's just all I've ever done is tried to stay with Him, whatever He's leading me to study. And I told a couple of people, maybe Ryan and I, but I know I mentioned to Anita, I mentioned to Gina. I said, I have no idea why I'm doing all this. I have no idea when I'm making these documents of all these quotes and all this stuff. And I started out just to answer some people on Twitter, because you'll say something and they'll come back with something and it's wrong, but I don't have the quote handy. So I just started putting together a few quotes. Well, I didn't know it was going to end up being 60,000 words of quotes. And so I don't know where it's going still. I think it's a book, but I don't know that. But that's a part of the research that I'll do here and that I'll do over there as well. And then I'll just take some time off. I want to take a few days and try to not do anything. And then on May 31st, I'll leave for Oxford and I'll be there. I'll arrive there on the 1st of June and be there till July the 16th. And I do have prayer that I do over there. It's a little different than here because, again, I'm not under pressure. I don't have things pressing on me to pray about. And so it ends up that you're able to pray about other things that are important, but you don't think about them in the same way. I'll do more research and writing on this critical race theory and cultural Marxism and maybe work on a book. I think that's what it is, but I won't complete it. And then I have another book on Calvinism that I've done a lot of research. It's just real disorganized, so possibly I'll be able to work on that as well. But I also, what I do is because you have wonderful old bookstores and stuff, and they have one bookstore there in Oxford, and I think the shelves, this bookstore, there's 3 miles of shelves. So it's a lot of books. And the resources for reading are just unimaginable. Plus, I get a pass to the Bodleian Library. So all of the 39 colleges of Oxford University have their own college and their own library, but they have a university library known as the Bodleian. And it has about 16 million volumes in it. And so you go and you get a reading room and then you order the books you need to study and they bring them to you. Because you can't access all of them. They're underground. They're under the city of Oxford. And so I think this is what students do to pay for their tuition, because there's about 400 people underneath the city working with the books in the library, and they bring them to your reading room. So I have that. I have the antiquarian bookstores that I go in, the old bookstores, and read. You go in these other bookstores. And then it's just a place where you walk down the street and they're having a C.S. Lewis thing, and you can go listen. Or they'll have world-renowned someone on something will be speaking down here at 6 p.m. And so you can just go in and I mean, you just don't have, I don't have that opportunity here, and I don't even have the time to do it. Nobel Prize winners will be there, and they'll just speak, or they'll have, I heard a world-renowned scientist on the brain one time, and heard C.S. Lewis, heard another person on another subject. And so you're just in this constant learning environment, but you can walk around, the weather's wonderful. And so I spend about 17 hours a day studying. That sounds worse than it is, because I wake up in the morning and I study at the flat, and then I get ready. I go to the library, which opens at about 10. I stay there. It closes at 5. So 3 to 5, I stay there and work. And then I go and get coffee, walk around a little bit, go back to the flat, eat, and then study some more, and then go walk again, come back, study some more, go walk again down the canal or in one of the fields that they have. And it's very relaxing. The weather is nice, so you can get out and walk. And so I'm under no pressure, though. So it's a long day. Then Gina comes over, depending on how long we're there, but she'll come over probably the last couple of weeks each time we do this. And because by the time I've spent 3 to 4 weeks alone doing this, and I really don't talk to anybody, so I don't meet any friends, and I'm lonely. And also, to keep up that pace, it gets a little harder as you go along. So she comes over. I still study in the mornings, but that's about 5 to 8 hours, depending on what we're going to do that day. And so I get up early and I study. And then in the afternoon, we go just relax. And again, you're just walking and looking at things and listening to people, and but mainly relaxing. But I still study, so I'm able to do that every day. I just can't keep up the pace, and I do get rather lonely. But one of the great things is about being there is the resources. The second thing that's great is that when you write, you need a place that inspires you. And if you read about authors, they'll talk about what inspires them. And Oxford inspires you. I mean, it's just all around you all the time. Even when you're walking down the canal, it's just inspiring. And you're where all of these people that we study and know and have read their writings, I mean, they were there. And so, and signs and indications of that are everywhere. So it's just real inspiring. There's a lot of resources. But the other thing is, I am isolated. So when I go on sabbatical, I do isolate myself. So I don't receive emails. So when I start on May 3rd till I come back August 22nd, I don't receive emails. Anita, all my emails go through Anita, so she holds them until I come back. I don't receive phone calls. And when I'm over there, I mean, I'm literally not in contact with anyone. I am totally isolated. Because I have to shut down. I have to get away from the responsibilities and so forth. And on a smaller scale, I say that everybody, I don't believe you can have a deep spiritual life today unless you can learn to isolate yourself to some degree. Now, you can't maybe do this, but I talked to some young men the other morning and I told them that very thing. I said, we are so accessible. I mean, anybody in the world can contact you. Do you understand that? That's mind-boggling. So we can't really have a deep spiritual life unless we can discipline ourselves to isolate ourselves. So whether it's an hour in a day, or one young man said, well, I put my phone up and everything and I go away by myself for an afternoon. And I said, good for you. So you have to isolate so that you're not accessible, that this isn't beeping and this isn't ringing and this isn't dinging and this isn't donging and all this stuff. It's just unbelievable how accessible we are. And young people think that's normal. It's abnormal. It's abnormal. And I like the accessibility, but you have to control it. So like a phone has a lot of benefits, but if you don't control it, it's just dogging your life all the time. And if you try to have devotional or time with God, you won't have it because it'll be interrupted. So I do this, and I do continued research and prayers during that time. July 16th through August 22nd, I come back here, and what I do then is take the research and all the things I've done, because it's not always well organized, and I try to keep working on that, getting that more organized back here. Some of my books that I need for what I'm writing are here, so I'm using books over there and the knowledge I have, but I have some that I have to incorporate here. I take some time off, and then I prepare to come back to Trinity, and we won't allow someone to go on sabbatical and come back on a Sunday. They have to come back on a Monday. Because you need to, and we require that week that you come back and it's not full time. That you come back, and if you're here a half a day, that's fine. Because once you've been off doing that, it just takes a little bit of time to crank back up. So I have prayer requests, and one of them is what God has for me. I don't know what all that is. I can tell you, and I've shared with the church a few things, but some of the most significant spiritual things, and maybe this is one of the reasons I do love Oxford so much, is that there have been times in my life where God's done a really significant spiritual thing that changed me in my direction. And a handful of those, this will be my eighth trip to Oxford, so in seven times, probably 3 to 5 or 6 of them happened in Oxford. So it has a real spiritual draw to me, thinking that God may have something else for me that's very significant. And so I look for that and I pray for that. And that can be unrelated to, by the way, what I'm over there doing. And let me just say this. So I have this book that's coming out on prayer and entitled, If Only You Would Ask. And it's about conditional praying. And it explains how we can pray about something that happened in the past, and God can actually answer the prayer, though it's not backward causation. We pray for other people, but how does that fit with them having free will? We actually pray God stop them from doing that, but how does that... It was when I was studying free will and how God knows things that I kept running into things and making notes about prayer, but I wasn't studying for prayer. It was the furthest thing from my mind. It wasn't on my schedule. It wasn't on my to-do over there. I was doing that. And then I preached that series here on prayer on this issue of God making certain prayers and promises conditional. If we ask, He'll do it. If we don't, He will not. And that's what the book is that, which you've already had a series on that, but the book goes in much more detail and explanation. But the point I want you to see is I didn't go over there to do that. That wasn't what I was studying, but I kept seeing these things that were answering very perplexing problems. And I kept writing them down. And out of that, I came to understand better how He does this and thus shared it with you. So I pray that that God has for Gina and me. And that has always been exceptional. And that there would be progress in concentration and doing what I think I'm there to do. Again, since God saved me, it's nothing about me because it's opposite of what my life was before. But He put in me a passion to know Him, to know His person, His will, His work, and His ways. And I am now at this stage. That was in 1978, and it's never changed. I wake up every morning with that. And so I'm praying that He will give me the concentration and the strength and the energy and the focus to do and use this time to its fullest extent. And I think about that because I know it's a great opportunity that the church gives me. And then there are prayer times and just, of course, safety as well. And God's been very good in all this. So you've done this and you've allowed us to do that. You're allowing me to do it. And I don't deserve it. But I will say, everything that I've done on sabbatical and whatever I've written about, much of it started in here, and I taught you something, and then I just kept thinking about it, and eventually it gets where you can't even preach a series on it because it's so long. So you write a book. Sometimes it's where God has me in these fields, and I'm studying, and I don't know why, and it ends up being a book or a paper, but then it gets turned into something that comes into the church. So you benefit by it, either on the front end or the backside, after I've done it somewhere else. So it's always to me about what God wants us to know, but I want it shared with other people. The first time this ever happened, I became a Christian. Remember, I didn't read or anything, but he put me to studying. And the first thing that I went out studying broadly on was charismatic beliefs. Because we were going to a Baptist church, a charismatic church, a charismatic Catholic church, and a Catholic church. So, I mean, it was pretty odd. And I had to figure out what was the truth. And so I spent about 2 years, I tried to read everything in print on that from the pro side. And then I read some on the con side. And then I tried to engage people and find answers. And that was really the first time that this had ever happened. And then it's happened subsequently. So anyway, I'll miss you while I'm gone. I'm grateful I have a place to come back to. And so I'm here for a couple of more weeks. And then on after we are planning on being in the worship center on May 1st. That's the plan. And so then I would leave on May the 3rd. So we're praying that will work. Okay, let me pray. Lord, thank you for this church. We love this church. We love each other. We're grateful for what you've given us by your grace. And it is genuinely a privilege to be able to shepherd here and to serve with people who love you and to see what you're doing and to be a part of it. We love you. We ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. Lord, give you a great, great week.